The Athletic.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
He's round the goalkeeper, he's done it! Absolutely incredible!
He launched himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter who was without a shadow of a doubt giving him lip.
Does it tame and tame and tame again?
Crank up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
Football's most timeless hashtag classy touch of all. The art of second half capitulations. Why Arsenal are just like the NHS. The relentless class of 92 content machine. The specific things that bookend the Monday to Friday Premier League news cycle. And the parallel universe that is the other Andre Villas-Boas. Brought to your ears by The Athletic, this is Football Clichés. Hello everyone and welcome to episode 97 of the Football Clichés podcast. I'm Adam Hurry and my right-hand man today is David Walker. Now, David, I'm not saying that some footballing interviews are inherently quite predictable before they even happen. But Steve Bruce, I'm told, is on 998 games as a manager. And that related interview isn't just so vivid in my head. I feel like I can almost taste it. Both the vibe and the specifics of that interview are so in my blood as a concept. For every word of it, I feel like has already happened.
You know, we talked about him just being sort of stuck in this permanently weary loop recently. This might be a nice little break for Steve to be able to talk about something with a bit more happiness and positivity as opposed to his ongoing purgatory at Newcastle United. How do you think it's going to go then? Come on, you tell us how you think it's going to go in your head.
He'll mention his wife and how, you know, in a kind of hilarious context, it's been difficult for her all these years and how he's had his ups and downs and how it's harder now with social media and all that sort of stuff. A few jokes thrown in. But yeah, I feel like this interview's already happened. But I'm looking forward to it nonetheless.
I'm very disappointed that his 999th game then will be at Vicarage Road this Saturday. We've missed out on the honour of welcoming Steve Bruce into the 1,000 club by one game.
He could get sacked after his 999th game. That would be awful. That'd be awful. That's too heartbreaking for me for the Steve Bruce pantomime. But speaking of world weary figures, our guest Pemeza Haaland-Dix today is he's my Barclays bellwether, a man once described by The Face magazine as 32-year-old British writer Clive Martin. It's Clive Martin. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. How are you guys?
Very well, very well. You're a very observant fellow. Where are you at as a kind of football/Premier League consumer these days?
I'm loving it. It's just, you know, I'm a big believer in the fact that football has to get more and more ridiculous. I'm very anti, not anti-grassroots, but I'm anti modern football brigade.
I know exactly what you mean.
I'm not like a FIFA guy or anything like that, but I think I love the idea of football like hurtling towards a kind of like critical mass and perhaps like an implosion of sorts.
Yes.
I think we need to get there. You know, I that whole like big merry-go-round that was nearly happened this summer.
Hmm.
When that point when like Haaland was going to go to PSG and Mbappe is going to like that, I wanted it to hit that point.
I feel like we're very close.
Exactly, like a real tipping point, just bang, right over the edge, and I was really hoping for that. So I was kind of sad that didn't happen in a way, but yeah, I'm enjoying the football. I think it's the most exciting thing in the world right now. I think it's hit a golden age, you know. It's kind of like Hollywood in the 50s or like sort of corporate rock in the 70s, you know what I mean? I think you saw that during the Euros, like a lot of people who weren't into football got into it because it was just the biggest, the most exciting thing in the world right now.
So this is Mesut Haaland-Dix. For those of you who don't know the drill, our star guest is going to pick three things that they love or simply fascinate them about football, followed by three hates/minor irritations about the game as well. Clive, kick us off with your first one, which looks pretty clear cut to me. I don't know how many layers they're going to be to this, but we'll find some.
Okay, so I've got players, there's something that I love, players visiting sick kids, particularly at Christmas in hospitals.
Okay.
I'm not like the most like sentimental person. I'm not the most emotional person, but like something about those sort of situations when they're contextualized with footballers, kind of like, obviously particularly my team, Chelsea players, kind of really hits me in the gut a little bit. I find it a very emotional experience looking at those pictures, and I really like that. It's a great tradition, isn't it? Which I guess probably didn't see last year because of COVID. I feel like there were some pictures of maybe one club wearing somewhere like full fucking hazmat suits in or something like that, you know, like,
so what a commitment to the classy touch.
Yeah. You get to see like I know Aaron Wan-Bissaka behind a some sort of like nuclear suit maybe, but like I think they're brilliant. One of the sort of few remnants of the old school, that sort of thing they did in the 70s, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's like you go to a local hospital. A lot of the times, it's the kids don't support the local team, so they're just sort of getting a visit from like, you know, the Man United fans getting a visit from like the Blackburn squad or something like that.
there's a cutoff point at which you stop thinking, wow, this kid must be incredibly starstruck and grateful that they're there, and a kind of cynical part of you starts to think, well, at this point, they're probably starting to feel slightly underwhelmed. Is that a terrible way of looking at it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was looking at some of them earlier, actually, and there's a lot of like Lee Grant or like a youth team player that no one's ever heard of again. There must be kids out there with like pictures themselves with like Kennedy, players like that. Wow, do you remember the time, Mum, when I was in hospital and we met Kennedy? David Luiz is like was a master of the form. Like he sells that experience so well. He's so good at it. There's so many. If you search like David Luiz sick children, he's like fucking Diana. You know, there's just so many of them, and he's so good at it.
It's a good point though, because I think there is an art to it. Like you've
got to go all in, right, Dave?
It must be pretty difficult for some of these guys who get, you know, young people who might only be sort of 18, 19, 20 themselves, but they're superstars or whatever. And all of a sudden you've got to go and be this sort of this big, warm, comforting, supportive, happy person with children who in some cases are undergoing terrible misfortune. And I'm sort of, I don't know why I should be surprised, but I am always sort of surprised. And I go, oh, he's good now. He's really nice. He can talk to the kids, like, you know.
And an extra layer of this, as Clive implied, is that when it's your own club's players, I mean, even tribalism even infiltrates this part of society. Just if you feel better about it because it's your club's players doing it. How pathetic it is. It's pathetic, isn't it? But it is also true. But you're exactly right at the start of this. Players visiting sick children in hospital is probably not even arguably the most timeless classy touch of all. As you say, you could have seen it in the 70s as often as you see it now. So we asked our listeners kind of what they thought was the original classy touch. What kicked off this kind of movement that really has only kind of been a thing for the last 15, 20 years maximum. Ryan Gray was the first to write in, and most topical of all, he says there's nothing classier than visiting kids in hospital with club merch gifts at Christmas, which of course was always filmed for the end of season review video. As a nice little addendum to this, he says, I was once one of those Christmas hospital kids. I got a lovely signed Christmas card and pencil case from Southampton, despite not being a supporter. He's basically the guy you're talking about. He is your man.
Maybe it's a bit of a recruitment drive in some of these places as well. So hearts and minds, you know.
I think the Athletic should start doing it. Send me into a hospital armed with three free subscriptions. Definitely, we should try it. If the marketing team hasn't thought of it, I'd be amazed. So moving on, Dylan E., says a player handing their shirt after a game to a child they've absolutely blasted a shot at during the match, presumably during the warm-up. Dave, Dave, this is almost contractually obliged classy touch territory. Like, if you don't do it, you're in real trouble.
Yeah, and so I was in, as we discussed the other day, I was at Norwich at the weekend, and it struck me that how many footballers these days, regardless of whether they've smashed a ball into someone's face in the game or the warm-up, go over and give their give their shirts or their boots, or it seems to be happening more and more these days. And I think
kids
maybe
begging
that's
with placards.
I think there's probably a little bit of like that to it, and there's always the there's two different things. There's either, you know, the wiser player, the players who are wise to some of the merchants out there who want to just get a shirt and flog it or whatever, or stick it on their YouTube channel, will like pick someone out and they'll like point ahead of time, say, no, I'm giving it to this person here.
Yeah, it's terrible.
And they'll give
it.
But then otherwise, or if that doesn't happen, it's the traditional sort of screw the shirt up, throw it. And then
I hate it in Wimbledon, and I hate it in Premier League football. Stop
and men
doing that.
Yeah, stealing it out of the hands of a child.
It really does reveal the worst in humanity when there are people fighting over a shirt thrown from a professional sports person.
There are also probably, you know, these days people who, you know, do the fans who do the can I have your shirt thing with a more achievable aim. Do you know what I mean? Like, Ronaldo, you might not get it from Ronaldo, but you might get it from, you know, I don't know. Like I said,
this is where Lee Grant comes back in.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why I keep picking on Lee Grant, but yeah.
Poor bloke.
Yeah.
Jack Pitbrook. So now we're perhaps getting to the sweet spot of where classy touches start. This is more perhaps sportsmanship territory. He says, surely Di Canio catching the ball that time. I think it was at Goodison Park, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. It was, yeah.
I think that was the Premier League's first real kind of moment of pure sportsmanship. Followed up swiftly, as Jay Martin suggests, Clive, by Robbie Fowler saying it wasn't a penalty against Arsenal in 1997. These are the two totems of Premier League humanity.
But then he went on to miss that penalty, didn't he?
Yeah.
But I feel like over time it's become sort of mythical that he missed it on purpose. But I don't think he did he? He just got saved.
It wasn't
by the
a very good penalty, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, it's quite hard to take an insincere penalty. Do you know? You know, it's like you either just sky it and it's really obvious, or you could just accidentally send the keeper the wrong way and score anyway. You know?
I've never thought about what my technique would be if I really wanted to miss a penalty out of guilt. I as you say, I wouldn't sky it because it would be too obvious. Maybe it's sort of, and putting any penalty wide looks a bit suspicious now anyway, because no one does that.
Really shit Panenka.
Right, okay. Well, yeah, but then there has to be the right occasion. But yeah, you're right. Players visiting sick kids at Christmas, the ultimate classy touch. Tell us about your second fascination of football.
This is where I've seen two of these, particularly even one team this season. It's the art of the second half capitulation. Like, I just love the emotional energy of going in when, you know, you've got all to play for, going in either as a 0-0 or a score draw, and then coming out a million times worse. I mean, like Tottenham done it twice this season, haven't they? Against us last week and against Palace, which I think was I think all the goals were after like 75 minutes against Palace, weren't they? I'm just fascinated what happens there. How unmotivational does the half-time have to be? You just come out and just fuck it up. Just like, you know, be utter crap, fall apart, players start turning at each other. There are a lot of these sort of like, forces of momentum in football, aren't they? Sort of emotional momentum, which is one of the most fascinating things about the game. And that's you don't see it that often, because generally you have like a halftime bounce, right? Even if you end up losing the game, but or the game's already gone, you don't care. But the idea of being in the game, coming out worse in the second half, which Tottenham have amazingly managed twice this season, like it's incredible, really.
I am fascinated by the vital components of a second half capitulation, Dave, because they are, as Clive suggests, the trajectory of it is so much more dramatic than just a full, gentle thrashing over 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And it kind of, there are very sort of certain signifiers of an impending capitulation, Dave. Panicked passes going out of play, a keeper sort of slicing it out for a throw. But when I think about all these little things that kind of bring forth a second half capitulation, I realise that the return of fans make things so much worse. It's at that point, when now fans are back, you realise how hard it must be for an away team to come back from, say, 2-0 down. Because the schadenfreude is so suffocating. If you miss a pass and you hear 30,000, 40,000 people saying, absolutely loving how bad you are at football, that must be crushing. People never talk about how difficult that must be psychologically for a footballer, just having lots of people willing you to be shit. That must be so hard.
Really hard. We had a capitulation on Sunday, just gone in Sunday League. It was the first half.
How many people were there?
It was a first half capitulation, right? We were 3-0 down very quickly. And I just felt so bad after the third goal went in. Like, it was just one of those days where just everyone was shit and like everything that happened went wrong. And I was like, oh, it really, so you're like, oh, God, I can't. You just really, you are rattled. And that's on Clapham Common when there is no one watching. Imagine being that person in a stadium full of 50, 60,000 people, you know, 75% of which are willing you to keep on fucking it up.
Yeah, well, this is it. The snowball effect, Clive. You know it's only going to go one way after a certain point. You knew that this was only going to happen. It was only going to go one way for Spurs after a certain point. It wasn't even the goal. It wasn't even the goal scoring. It was just the general vibe of it. You just said they're running out of
If you don't come out that tunnel fired up, like, and so you can see in the player's eyes, you can still, something weird happened in the team talk. You know, there was either like an argument between the players, started blaming each other, or just they've come out with a kind of a deeper uncertainty than they went in with it. You can see it in the eyes, you know, and they Tottenham came out and they were like, they're gonna fall apart here, and they did in style, you know. It's like an act of God, really. You know, it's sort of things can't get any worse.
We asked our listeners for the vital components of a second half capitulation. Some excellent contributions here. Collins T26 uses the same case study. He says, I only need to glance back to Sunday Spurs Chelsea game for a reference. The capitulator has to be in the game for at least a half, either drawing or just a goal down, before losing by at least three goals. And someone has to get in on the act, like Antonio Rudiger in stoppage time. So that's the kind of the final turn of the screw, isn't it? When someone you wouldn't perhaps expect to score, scoring away from home and just really ramming it home.
I mean, that's the funniest thing about the Spurs game. Like, you know, a glancing N'Golo Kante, like, off the post goal, like a centre-back scoring, a Timo Werner assist, like a set-piece header from, you know, a guy who's not one of the taller people in the box. Like, just like absolute crap, you know?
I enjoy the body language of a capitulating team, Dave. After a certain point, maybe the sort of third or fourth goal, especially if it's happened in quick succession, my eyes are inevitably drawn to kind of maybe the senior defender in the middle of the 6-yard box, just to see what his reaction is. And they sort of turn around to nobody in particular, sort of hold their hands out and say, what the fuck are they doing here? How dare they let this happen to me? Or a goalkeeper pretty much doing the same thing.
You're right. Like, watching the reaction of the capitulating team is always interesting. And I think for most fans, there will be a player at each club who you would, once they've stopped clapping and trying to get people back up again and say, oh, come on, lads, we keep going and all that. Once their heads go down, you think, oh, okay, we're in trouble here. He's not clapping anymore. Even his head's gone down now. We are in big trouble. Because past a certain point, what is the point? If you're 4-0 down or something, you know, and then maybe there's 10 minutes left or whatever. I mean, one of these teams, you know, one of the Southampton players who've lost 9-0 in the last few seasons, like after the seventh goal's gone, what the hell are you, what's the point?
Well, exactly, because then you are into absurd territory then, Clive. You're into a situation where all the kind of protocols of being a professional footballer kind of should go out the window because the game is essentially gone. So the veneer must slip. So there must be at least one or two players on the team who are so selfish, I just think, I've fucking fed up with a lot of you, and you can see it in their body language.
Big time, yeah. I mean, my favourite shot of it's like the Sky Sports staple is the it's hard to explain. It's like I'd say probably three players very much in focus. The goal's gone in. One's got their head down.
Yeah.
One's sort of like hands behind their head.
A tableau of despair. Yeah.
Yeah. The crowd is going, the away crowd or the home crowd is going crazy behind them, very much out of focus.
There's a missing element to that, and it's the player who has the who either takes it upon themselves or is bestowed upon them by the proximity of the ball in kicking the ball back. Like, with what sort of energy do they kick that ball back?
About goal five, it's a really limp kick back, isn't it? It's not angry anymore. It's just sort of poking it back in the general direction. Yeah.
And then of course there's kicking the ball back in the own net in fresh kicking, scoring the frustration goal.
Yes.
The frustration own goal. That's a real like 5-0 one.
Okay. I really enjoyed that one. Classic cliches territory. Tell us about your third enduring fascination of football. An open ended one, this one perhaps.
Yeah, it's just Arsenal Football Club. they are my enduring fascination. Sometimes I think I like seeing Arsenal lose more than I like seeing Chelsea win. I think they're one of the great British institutions. They're like the NHS or the two Ronnies. they just give so much to our lives. I feel like everything they do is amazing. Like it's only getting better as well. Like I was talking about football, like generally getting better and more exciting and more interesting. Arsenal are doing very much, they're becoming more of a character themselves. Like, they started this season so beautifully, losing to a promoted team first game, getting done by us in a derby, getting done by City, like worse than anyone possible, you know, that everyone's going to be a mauling. And it was a horrible casual mauling in the end. And then like the little bit of hope creeping back in, which is always makes them perfect, you know. It's like it stops them making the decisions they need to do as well. And, you know, it's like this comes up, they have these ridiculous false idols. Like, I was like, we need to play Martinelli and Balogun up front. And then Martinelli and Balogun do for up front and they lose 4-0 and stuff like that. And then they're sort of back to square one. My friend Tushin is an Arsenal fan, called me out on Twitter saying that I was more obsessed with Arsenal than him. And it is true. I'm completely obsessed with them.
You have set this up perfectly. I mean, you basically summarised all the bullet points I had written out for this. But your point about being more interested in seeing Arsenal lose than Chelsea win is a very interesting one, because there might be some Arsenal fans listening to this who are kind of, you know, frantically fast forwarding 10 minutes because they don't want to hear people slagging their club off. At the same time, there's probably non-Arsenal fans who are fast forwarding 10 minutes because they are sick of hearing about Arsenal. But on both counts, they need to stay, because Arsenal's malaise, ongoing malaise, it's for everybody. That's the weird thing.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
It isn't theirs to own. I feel like we all own it now. We all had to basically endure the coverage of it for so long, and not just enjoying it, you know, if you don't support them. So it really is something for everybody in there. I feel like we've all participated in this over the last 10 to 15 years.
To compare them to another great British institution, they're kind of like the royal family. I think we have this sort of, there's sort of like a public ownership of their demise, isn't there?
Definitely.
But they throw up all these amazing characters, and then you got like fan TV like compounding it. I mean, fan TV wouldn't work with any other club. Other clubs have tried it and they're all crap. Like, fan TV is just perfect. It's the indignation and the that sense of decline from the golden era, and also these sort of like the galaxy brain takes. The Arsenal fans are amazing for galaxy brain takes. Like, I've seen some astonishing ones over the years. You know, let's play a back four of all our fullbacks. Let's play Xhaka up front. You know, I'm making these up, but they're also right. I'm also fascinated with the saga of William Saliba, who's this sort of like prodigal son who I reckon will never play a game for Arsenal. That would be my prediction.
You're so right with you said they had these false idols. They really do seem to have these sort of fringe players that they get. They either come up through the youth ranks, or they buy young from abroad, and it's like, yeah, they're going to be the one, and they sort of play a bit, and they play in a League Cup or Europa League, and Arsenal fans think they're great, but then we never see them, and then my Arsenal mates are always like, oh, but he's really good, and when he plays, he'll be great, but they're never great.
Yeah, but it isn't just about good players, it's not just about promising players, it's about characters. Arsenal go through cult heroes like no other club. Their cult heroes seem to last about 6 months each. Kolasinac, just for being massive, for example. A lot of Arsenal fans denied this, but it was definitely the case.
There's a thing Arsenal fans do when it's like, because there's a big thing about, and they did it with Kolasinac, and they've just done it with Partey. It's exactly the same trajectory. It's okay, they always get this reputation for being a bit feeble in certain positions, and then they sign like a big bloke. They sign Kolasinac or Partey, and they're like, "Yes, the beast has arrived to save Arsenal." And then the club, the media, they push it. That whole thing about Xhaka and the keys. Remember that? It's all that kind of stuff. And there's this sort of like post-Vieira vacuum. They're always desperate, and Adams vacuum, they're always desperately trying to fill. And these guys are just seen as like duds within a couple of weeks. Always good. Like, expectation is so high, and they're often sort of misrepresented in what they do and what have you. Just because they look hard. There's got a lot of blokes who look hard that have turned out to be the opposite of that. And there's so many of them. Party's that already. No Partey, no Partey, whatever. What that feels so long ago now.
I've got 2 points to make now here as an attempt to make a counterpoint here. First, Clive, to you. Well, you've presented this case so far as Arsenal fans and Arsenal as a concept being such an island from the rest of football. It behaves in its own little ecosystem, and we just sort of just look in and enjoy it. Are they really any different to any other club? Are they really any different to any other set of fans? Are they really reacting to their situation in a different way to anybody else would?
Well, I think this is the interesting thing, is I think they're pioneers. I think they, most clubs are going the way Arsenal have been for a while. You know, the partisan stuff, I see a lot of it creeping into Chelsea now, which ghouls me no end. But like, I see a lot of these sort of micro arguments and camps and factionalism going on. Like, you know, there's sort of like a pro Mount camp, a pro Havertz camp, a pro whatever, you know, kind of thing. And they've been doing that for a long time. And they've always been, Arsenal fans have been really big on social media. And like fan TV, they pioneered that kind of fan media stuff.
So I think fans of other clubs are kind of jealous of the way they're going about things. Yeah, they actually look genuinely in their misery, enjoying themselves more than anybody else.
Yeah, and I've seen it in like Championship clubs and stuff like that. You know, sometimes you get like a quiet day on Twitter, some Sheffield Wednesday, you end up on a thread of Sheffield Wednesday fans, and you see them coming out with these like really goonery sort of like reactionary takes. You're like saying that like, we don't want Gary Cahill, we need someone to play the ball out more. And then they'll cite like some teenager from some Premier League academy they should be getting instead. Like, Arsenal fans, Arsenal fans have been like that for years, but everyone's kind of an Arsenal fan now.
That's a good point. They're Arsenal are sort of great for being the club that somebody like Graham Souness or any one of those guys will go, you know what, Chris Wood, he'd do a job at Arsenal. Why haven't they got Gary Cahill? Why didn't they go out and get...
They're always the case study for this hypothesis, always. Dave, Clive kind of compared Arsenal to the NHS as a national institution. And
being overrun by Americans, being ruined by the American takeover.
A very interesting parallel for so many reasons, but much like the NHS, I don't really understand its inner workings, I don't really understand how it maintains itself. And I sympathise to an extent with people who may not understand football economics on a grand scale, and they don't understand how modern clubs are structured. And I kind of include myself in both of those camps. And those people probably just don't understand why Arsenal are still shit. There's no logic to them, apart from being this kind of banter club, who are kind of now at DNA level comically bad, or at least, you know, average. A lot of people cannot understand how they haven't managed to turn things around in 16 years of since they last won something, you know, important. It's a huge mystery to people, surely.
They are definitely an institution, and that's something that they sort of perpetuate themselves as well.
Definitely.
You know, there's still the whole thing around, even though they're not at Highbury, the sort of marble halls and the bust of Herbert Chapman and Sir Chips Keswick, and there's all these sort of figures that surround the club that, you know, it just is stuck, even though it is obviously Arsene Wenger and everything's very progressive, very modern. They brought about change in English football. They're still sort of anchored and weighed down, I suppose, by their sort of past. But, you know, the interesting comparison is Manchester United. Like,
no one thought they were going to continue to be shit for a very long time.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And they weren't. Mm. And even through Fergie, he had his ups and downs, but he always came back. Mm. And when they got rid of him, it was catastrophe with Moyes, but then they got Van Gaal and they sort of were okay. And Mourinho, they're okay. And they've muddled their way through. They've been shit, but they're sort of still there. Whereas Arsenal, there's just, as we sort of discussed on the crisis episode, there's just been slow, steady decline.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that, you know, apart from the FA Cups, there's just been, they had it all. They got given everything. They literally won the league without losing a game, like the most amazing thing in Premier League history, really. And then they just had nothing else like it since. And it's just, now I think it's like full circle. This Arsenal is now the Arsenal that I knew when I first started liking football, that was managed by Bruce Rioch.
Right.
That's basically where they are again.
If it spans generations, then you know you really are in trouble. Okay, having alienated perhaps about 8 to 12% of our listenership over the last 10 to 15 minutes. I think we'll leave it there. But it is a fascinating section of football consumption. I think we've established that. Okay, welcome back to Mesut Haaland Dix. Clive Martin is with us. Clive, it's now time to take us down the various avenues of your footballing hates / niche irritations. What have you got for us first?
I just realised how much the Arsenal one sounded like a hate thing. But
yeah,
that's not,
fine.
I mean,
it was
inevitable. Arsenal,
but that's okay.
It's the class of 92 content machine.
Okay.
And it's a funny one because, yes, they did dominate a lot of Premier League history, but they're also intent on rewriting Premier League history in their own image. Every time I turn on the telly, there is some sort of like, for instance, just this morning when I was actually thinking about this before, I even there was a thing about Gary Neville's set up some kind of social enterprise. And it's a nice idea, stuff like that. For some reason, it's got the numbers 92 in it.
The University of 92 is what he's
exactly
been plugging today.
Yeah, stuff like that. There's this orthodoxy, sort of like just creating this this content machine that churns out everything from boring fucking stories about the hairdryer on Sky Sports, Roy Keane talking about like leadership, what leadership means. Did you hear that? You know that Premier League years documentary they're doing on the BBC right now?
Oh, with the Fever Pitch, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a bit at the end of that where it's like, they're still going through the early days of football, and then it's like, but then someone was really needed to take football into a new generation amongst people that have never watched a game before, and they do this like corny intro, and David Beckham sort of walks in the room and sort of sits down and goes, "All right."
The documentary is made by David Beckham's
production company. That's what I was about to say. Like, imagine the ego it takes to make this documentary in which you about your team basically, and that you sort of present yourself as this sort of hero at the end of the first episode who comes in and changes everything. And there's so much of that with these guys. Like they made that film and that fucking Salford City stuff. Like, does anyone ever ask them what's going on with Salford City these days? That whole thing. And I actually interviewed Phil Neville about it. He gave this very like sincere, like tub thumping interview about, you know, his plans for Salford City. And I've not heard a peep about it, and like Inter Miami sort of ties into that now and stuff like that. They're just they're omnipresent and they're annoying, and they're just this sort of like they're like the Beatles.
Clive, you mentioned that you mentioned the word kind of omnipresent. So you're right, they are everywhere. You cannot watch a football broadcast without a class of 92 pundit somewhere along the line. But it's quite a benign omnipresence. They're not really pushing an agenda in any big agenda. I mean Neville,
it's a brand, though.
Gary Neville is sort of, but otherwise it's not even that massively egotistic. They're just there because they're part of the footballing furniture. I don't know how self-propelled it is.
It's a brand, though. It's brand 92. And I think if you were probably to start looking into Company's House and stuff like that, you really would sort of like start to see their the machinations of it all. There's a class of 92 brand, isn't it? Which I think they're determined to squeeze every bit of money out, every bit of content you could possibly imagine out of.
Do you think they've got any stories about Ferguson left? Surely not.
Only the ones we actually do want to hear, yeah. Yeah. The ones they won't say, you know? Yeah, I'd love to hear what he's actually like, yeah.
Dave, why does nobody ever talk about the class of 93? it feels weird to even say the words. I mean, it might be a sort of terrible sequel. The most damning thing you can say about the class of 93 is that it has at least two players you can't click on in Wikipedia. So that was the real fall from grace for 93. But Phil Neville, who, I mean, I imagine this must have been said quite a lot, is not of the class of 92 and yet appears in every single photo opportunity they have. That's the biggest scandal of this, isn't it?
And like poor old Robbie Savage, who actually was in the class of 92 at Manchester United.
Yeah.
But,
He's just too Leicester.
So close to being part, and obviously he's had forged a very successful career in his own right, but so close to being, he could have been part of the club. And like Ben Thornley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all those lads.
Present that narrative, don't they? The one that didn't make it. But Savage doesn't get a look in, because he just doesn't fit the brand.
He is airbrushed out of it, isn't he? Really? He's always in that the team photo, and you can recognise him, but he's not. Yeah, he's not even presented as one of the ones that missed out.
Mm.
Yeah,
I want to see John O'Kane on BT Sport. I want to see these players given an airing. Yeah, no.
But on the flip side of that, Beckham, I've always felt, because Beckham is not. Obviously, he's part of the class 92 in terms of his playing career, and he was part of the kids, part of Fergie's fledglings, who was to give them their original title.
Just to interrupt you there, I heard Pep's Pups this week, which is the nadir.
That is a disgrace.
Of this intermittent genre.
Pep's Pups.
Pep's Pups is the
doesn't pits. Even play him.
Exactly.
You can't get like a collective name if all you ever do is like get a little run out and the league
the Pups, right. Yeah. They're up for adoption. But Beckham, I think that there's a part of him that I think probably doesn't want to be part. He's not really part of the gang, is he? You've got the Manchester lads, the sort of local Manchester lads who always kind of, they're all still based in Manchester. They do things in Manchester. They're Salford. Even though Beckham, I think, is Beckham actually part of the Salford thing as well? I think he probably is on paper. But now he's got into Miami. That's his thing. I don't think Beckham really is bothered about the class of 92, but he can't get away from it.
On the other hand, I do feel like, Clive, every friendship group has that kind of person who's just a little bit, well, a lot more successful than the rest of them, and then will make it back for the odd get-together. And they say, oh, here he is. And he's like, he's tanned, and he's just much better off than the rest of them, but still sort of slides back into it nice and easily.
I'd like to think that's me amongst my friends.
Maybe
I'm more like Ronnie Woolworth.
That's exactly how I see you. Okay, Clive, tell us about your second footballing hate / niche irritation.
It is, and again, there is a class of 92 crossover in this. It's the predictability of the the heated debate.
Mm.
The inevitability of it, perhaps.
Yep.
Every time something vaguely controversial happens on a game of in-game football, not like political stuff, but like a handball, an offside, a decision of sorts, whatever. It's the inevitability of an argument between Micah Richards and Graeme Souness about it. I just want some of these days, even with like the Reece James handball incident. It's very difficult decision to work out what's going on there, but like I just didn't want anyone to talk about it. It's got to that point. I'd just rather these things happen. Let sleeping dogs lie. Let's not talk about it.
No, you can't have that.
So it's impossible. So boring. Yeah, and there's this like partisanship, this factionalism, that this need to take a side and this need to adopt a persona from all the commentators. It's so boring, and it's boring on Sky Sports, and it's boring on Talk Sport when it's Simon Jordan. And they're always going on about something as well, and it's just like, oh, it's just like football broadcasting as panto. And there's so much like interesting stuff being done in the sort of field of football journalism, and But like it just that people really still think that an argument about an offside is like the peak of football broadcasting. It's awful. Can't stand it.
I find that this is a really interesting point. It's something I've been thinking about a lot lately, actually. So over the last couple of years, right, I've been getting more into NFL and sort of taking a bit more interest in American sports, partly due to being exposed to them for working for The Athletic, right? And there are a couple of shows over there. There's one in particular on Fox, which is Skip Bayless and Shannon Sharp. Skip's like a old journalist, kind of a bit like, you know, a bit like Adrian Durham or someone like that who's kind of there to whip up opinions. And Shannon used to play in the NFL, right? But they're both just take any of the debates you see on English radio or TV and multiply it by a million and Americanize it. And I sit there and I love it. I'm watching it and I'm like, this is brilliant. This is really entertaining. They're really charismatic. They're going back and forth. But I think the reason I love it is because I don't actually know what they're talking about.
You haven't built up the fatigue.
I haven't got the intricacies of the NFL or the NBA. I don't know if their points are valid or not. I'm just loving it for the entertainment. Whereas I think with football, I know too much about football because I can immediately spot when they're talking shit and when they've got a point or where they over-egging it, and it just doesn't land with me. So I think football fans, in a way, this is like sports broadcasting as entertainment. It's probably increasingly not for us.
I think this is a perfectly good point, but when we talk about sort of the endless debates that cycle each week, now, Clive, I know you know this, so I feel like a little bit of your complaint is disingenuous because you must know.
Yeah, no, I think it is.
Stuff like this isn't just the oil of the machine; it is the machine. You can't have a Friday to Monday Premier League news cycle without this stuff. There would be nothing left. You would literally have nothing else to talk about or have spoken to you. There's nothing left.
I know. Yeah. And I know that the game itself hinges on some of these moments, and they do define games, and they are up for debate, and they are there are vaguenesses there and stuff like that. You do need to talk about, but this is very much I'm being incredibly selfish here, and it does my head in, and I feel like I've watched enough of my life to do without it. Yep. You know, I almost hate seeing it happen because I've got to hear about it again. Do you know what I mean? It's like a Christmas dinner argument, you know, about I don't know, some sort of controversial culture war issue. Mm. You know, it's so boring. I don't want to hear about either side about this stuff.
It kind of puts me off, Dave, of watching Match of the Day. Because I know I'm going to be exposed. I kind of want to watch the goals, even though I've probably seen them on Reddit or something. I know I'm going to be subjected to 2 minutes of was this or was this not a handball and what does this mean for the next few years of football. I don't want to listen to it, but I guess we have to appreciate that some people do.
But that's exactly. That's exactly my point. I think everyone on this call has just seen too much football.
Yeah, that's terrible.
That's
effort.
The problem.
We are more enthusiastic than we sound, I'm sure. Okay, so I asked our listeners, Clive, how they bookend the Friday to Monday Premier League news cycle. What is that? What heralds the start of it? Of a whole new fresh set of controversies, and what is the harbinger of it all, and what brings it to a close. So, kicking off with Dave O'Leary, who says, the Premier League news cycle begins with the BBC's never much illuminating Premier League countdown and press conferences Friday live blog, and ends with some whipped up dispute on Monday night football that bleeds into Tuesday morning, rinse and repeat. So I feel like he's world weary enough to get us started. Has he got it just about right? Yeah, it's that kind of...
That's quite niche.
And dreams, and then dismantling it all by Tuesday.
Yeah, I mean the press conference roundup is really that's someone who consumes a lot of football media. You can tell that. Yeah, I think that's about right. I always think running concurrently to the 12:30 kickoff Football Focus, sort of like the profiles on Football Focus, still like the start that feel like a setup of a weekend a lot of the time. You know, like
so innocent, aren't they?
Yeah. Or a slightly determined interview with like Mo Salah or something like that. You know, and that sort of like very much contextualizes the games coming up, even though one of those games already kicked off. It's a set menu, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It really is. But Dave, I feel like we now know exactly when it starts and finishes. Nick Murphy says Garth Crooks' team of the week is the traditional Monday curtain raiser to the new week. That really is. That Excellent. Wipes the slate clean, doesn't it, Dave?
Yeah, very good. And it's sort of weekend preview counterpart Loro's predictions.
Oh, yes. That's it. They are the two cornerstones of a Premier League weekend.
I can't believe they're still doing Loro's predictions.
I think the level of fame you need to be on Lawrenson's predictions is at an all-time low, Clive.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's terrible, terrible. Some real nobodies. Did you ever see Idris Elba's one?
No.
Idris Elba did it. He'd obviously really not watched football in a long time. Mm. And been living in LA, but he was desperate to sort of like stay relevant. So he's just sort of doing this like umming and ahhing, going like, ooh, Wolves, two. Yeah, just like the way you're trying to sell it, like, I'm still invested in this thing.
Yeah. Jack Pearce, I think, provides the deluxe. It begins when the first manager of the weekend walks into a training ground room with a vending machine hot drink to speak to the press, and ends the moment that Jamie Carragher asked the Monday Night Football guests what the best moment of their career was. That is the ultimate slice of Premier League culture. When Monday Night Football gets to historical chat, that's when I know my weekend is over, Clive. That's my Premier League consumption is over.
It's a long weekend, isn't it? It's Friday to Monday.
Really long.
It's not... Yeah. Friday morning to Monday evening.
Yeah, Monday is just, without any questions asked, just co-opted as part of the weekend.
Yeah.
Because you've got to have reaction. You've got to have fallout.
Which was actually, that was in that Premier League years documentary. Cause obviously, Monday Night Football is an NFL thing. And they were saying that, like, I think one of the, I think like David Dean, one of the sort of Premier League architects, was saying they really wanted to copy that model where the weekend's not over until Monday Night Football's not over. But only recently have we really seen that, I think. It's become like part of the set menu of football media of the weekend, yeah.
I've never thought about how much of an impact it's had on the entire football industry in terms of stringing out its content and its income. I've never thought about it like that. But yeah, I guess we all kind of benefit from it in a way, or suffer, depending on how...
100%, yeah.
Yeah, a bit of perspective. Your third footballing hate/irritation... this is perhaps the...
Just hate. Just pure hate. Unbridled hatred.
Again, a potentially very open-ended one, but I'm fascinated to hear you state your case for this one.
Look, there's not many individuals I hate in the game at all, but one of them is Andre Villas-Boas.
You hate him?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got several reasons for this. I'm not just going to say dropping JT, like my dad would say. I always thought there's a horrible sense of privilege to him. Without getting too political about it, he very much feels like a rich kid who kind of gamed his way into it via meeting Bobby Robson in the same apartment block they lived in Lisbon, some sort of luxury apartment block. Not just to hate him for his background, but I always thought he has the vibe of a guy who read Moneyball and thinks he can do it. You know, it's like, and that transcends, he's one of those guys who just looks at something and thinks, he has that innate confidence, doesn't he?
Yep.
That he thinks he can do anything, and that transcends right up to him trying to do the bloody Dakar rally. You know, he's like he's like Lord Mountbatten or someone like that. He just thinks he can like turn his hand to anything, and he's like, but you know, he hasn't done that well in football. And I think you saw that side to him when he dug out that young Celtic player that was going to go to Marseille. He said he didn't want him publicly, like really, really dug him out publicly. And it's just this horrible like sort of attitude he has. That whole thing about when he was like sleeping in a pod at Stamford Bridge also really weirds me out. Do you know this?
To kind of extend his kind of rich kid narrative, he had a kind of like a gap year equivalent. He was the technical director for the British Virgin Islands national team at the age of 21,
yeah.
Which exactly. I feel like no other manager could ever have done.
It's a data job, isn't it? I imagine he was just looking through some sort of database, looking at players you could potentially qualify for that citizenship and sort of going through it. You know, I saw there's something snide about him, and like some of the like decisions he made at Chelsea were awful, and he's been underwhelming everywhere he's been, but really arrogant, like not very like snappy, snarky kind of guy. The sort of nasty sort of like thin beard that he has.
On that point, on the point of his kind of innate confidence and arrogance, I find it quite impressive. I agree with you on some of these points. I wouldn't go full out to say he's a fraud, because I'm not quite sure what the elements of being a fraud are just yet. But
yeah.
There are some elements of his arrogance and confidence which I find genuinely impressive. He did an interview recently with The Athletic's James Horncastle, and there were two nuggets of pure gold. First, he kicked off the entire interview by saying, "I am, let's say, a bit of a hipster." No manager has ever said those words. I feel like no one involved in football should ever embrace those actual words. So that's a great start.
In what way did he qualify that?
It was kind of left unexplained, but the idea was that yes, he does indeed kind of follow far-flung football, but not to the extent that the caricature says he does. And then later on, a genuinely brilliant quote. This is about him being interviewed for jobs. He says, when I have these conversations with owners and presidents, the day somebody says to me, Andre, we're interviewing you because you have a 68% win ratio in football and we need to win, that's why we're interviewing you, I'll say, congratulations, that's the right answer.
Oh, man.
That's bad.
I can't get one round just for having read that quote. Maybe you are right.
That's like Patrick Bateman saying that or something, yeah, isn't it? Yeah. That's a really psychopathic thing to say, actually.
But it's still impressive. I still find it impressive that someone would talk like that and get away with it. But
does he get away with it, though? I mean, he's sort of like very much off the
football radar, isn't he? Well, he's one wee round a little bit.
He's probably very influential in some of the things that he did in terms of, like, you know, using, you know, some of the players. He's signed some really good players and what have you. But, and you know, just his... There's a lot more Andre Villas-Boases in the world now, but just the man himself, yeah, I don't like him at all. He creeps me out.
There is an element to him, yeah. You mentioned the other Andre Villas-Boases of the world. I feel like he was the one that kind of went over the top first.
Yeah.
He went into no man's land.
Like Arsenal, a pioneer.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
To his own detriment.
He sort of spawned a million, like Watford managers, you know?
Yeah. Dave, how do you feel about that?
Wouldn't be surprised if he one day
going to manage Watford,
darkened our door. Yeah,
yeah, completely. Yeah, right. I want to pick up on an excellent little snapshot of mid-career Villas-Boas. This is when he was at Spurs, and perhaps being a little bit too front foot, a little bit too clever for his own good. This is him at a press conference being questioned about not giving Hugo Lloris his debut just yet.
Andre, can you understand Hugo Lloris's frustration about the situation? Because you did pay quite a lot of money for him.
What is the frustration?
Well, frustration of not being in the team.
How do you know?
Well, he didn't play last night, did he?
How do you know he's frustrated?
No, I'm asking you, do you find him frustrated?
No, you are saying that what you think about Hugo Lloris' frustration. I'm asking you what kind of frustration.
Has he actually come to you and said, look,
no,
he's not
frustrated.
But so he's obviously happy with the situation.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Clive, I quite like seeing a manager kind of interrogate the kind of sort of semi-automated media cycle. That's a good thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a good thing to do, but then he also goes back on himself, doesn't he? He says, I'm not frustrated. He's not frustrated. And then at the end, he goes, so he is frustrated. And then he goes, obviously.
So he hasn't
really, he hasn't really sort of proved himself. He hasn't really backed his own horse there, has he? Mm.
Dave, Andre Villas-Boas' name came up in a piece Tom Warville wrote the other day about Jose Mourinho's 1,000 games as a manager. My diligent job as a sub-editor, I realised that the name I was looking at was in fact a different Andre Villas-Boas, who was at Porto at the same time. He was just a jobbing defensive midfielder who was knocking around the Porto B team around the time they won the Champions League. Went on to play for Maritimo, Porto Moinense on loan, finished his career at Rio Ave in 2017, played for the Portugal under-20s in 2004... Just had a much more leisurely existence. This kind of parallel Andre Villas-Boas. I'm fascinated by this guy. We need to get hold of him, surely.
So is this like the Portuguese equivalent of what are the two Stevens players?
Gary Stevens.
Gary Stevens.
Yeah, this is the Gary Stevens that lives in Thailand.
Yeah.
Just has a great time on the beach.
I don't know which Gary Stevens, but they definitely get called up like and interviewed thinking, and the interviewer doesn't even know that it's the wrong Gary Stevens from time to time. So I bet the other Andre Villas-Boas has definitely got loads of media requests to do interviews about the Dakar rally and stuff.
This Villas-Boas even had a go, Clive, at being the proper Villas-Boas. After retiring at the age of 34 in 2017, he spent a year scouting for Rio Ave before becoming their sporting director. He resigned 4 years later following their relegation. Just couldn't do it. Just couldn't be a full Villas-Boas. The next twist, perhaps the final twist in the Villas-Boas story, is that he's still only 43. He's barely 2 years older than Mourinho when he won the Champions League with Porto. He is still comfortably a young manager. How much mileage is there left in the Villas-Boas narrative?
So how old were you when he was Chelsea manager then? So how long ago was that now?
He was 33.
Like 8 and 8.
Yeah, he's an old. He would have been a really old looking 33. That beard, it's the beard and the sort of and the deep voice.
I guess he had a bit of a sort of like knows how to present himself with a sort of air of authority, which is suddenly like, dropping JT. That kind of you need more minerals than that. Only Benitez, fair enough, but yeah.
I mean, but the thing is, we all knew he was a fraud from day one. In the first press conference, when he said, "I am the group one," you think, "Oh, that's rubbish."
Yeah, that was one of the worst ones that Chelsea have had.
The group one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is.
Terrible.
Yeah, but you know, if you're put on the spot and you haven't got one ready, what are you going to say? I don't know which one I would choose. I just don't know.
He also tried to do Mourinho, do a bit of sex appeal, and sort of quickly people realise he has zero sex appeal. You know, he's like, he's not bad. He's a, not a bad looking guy, but he's just like, he's very unsexy.
Like, yeah, he's one of his. One of his ancestors, well, close ancestors, is like a Viscount or something. His brother's an actor.
Yeah, exactly.
This should all add up to something quite sexy, but it's not.
Yeah. There's quite sort of, he could be in sort of Portuguese Succession, couldn't he?
Yeah.
He has that sort of air about him, yeah.
Exactly right. Okay, well, this is it. So we've covered players visiting sick kids at Christmas as the ultimate classy touch. We've dissected the art of the second half capitulation, which was thoroughly enjoyable. I feel like we've solved Arsenal Football Club. So well done to you, Clive. I don't know if that's what you wanted, but that's it.
I want Edu's job. That's what I want.
You could sneak into the Arsenal hierarchy and nobody noticed. There's so many people in there.
Sign Troy Deeney.
Yeah, no one would ever know. The class of 92 content machine, the endless Friday to Monday Premier League news cycle, and a frankly bitter, cruel dismantling of André Villas-Boas, whose career is only just getting started, quite frankly.
There you go.
As are all of ours. Thanks so much for joining us, Clive. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, no worries. Enjoy
it. Hope you've got a lot off your chest.
Yeah, exactly. It was cathartic.
Good, good. Glad to hear it. Thanks to you, Dave, too.
Thank you.
And see everyone next time. Cheers. The Athletic.